So this is week four. It feels like it's much longer, don't you think? It feels like we've gotten through a lot. That was a positive way to say that. So week four, rational choice. So what we're going to try and do is connect what we talked about this morning, rational choice games, you know, prisoner's dilemma and such like, with the institutional analysis and development framework. Okay, there's a strong connection. I think you do have to understand the games to understand how the IED developed, but it's not always obvious what these connections are. So let's go through them. So we start with definition. So rational choice theory, I think, describes very broadly the use of mathematics, economics, and political science to produce insights on politics and policymaking, something like that. I don't think you can find a more precise definition than that, unless people just say, oh, it's the application of economics to political science. But, you know, economics is really the application of mathematics to economic issues. So what I wanted to do is, if you'll go with me, just stop me when this gets too much, is to just go into some of the brief story of the historical context for all this, because now I don't propose you do this, but if you compare the chapter on rational choice in the first edition of Understanding Public Policy with the second one, you would see a major difference in the amount of words I give to rational choice compared to the IED. And rational choice has really gone down. It would be about 10,000 words on the history, and partly because rational choice used to be incredibly popular within the political science profession, and, you know, to a large extent it dominated political science. You know, in terms of who was making the high status careers and who was publishing in the highest status journals, it was for a while it was really rational choice dominant. And so, you know, the first edition was trying to capture why that was so important and make some kind of connections to the kind of things that we talk about. And they're not obvious connections. So we talked to some extent about some of the assumptions that people make with rational choice. And this becomes relevant. So I think bear in mind these kind of assumptions that they make, they become more and more relevant when you think about the trade-offs we make with analysis. Okay, so usually rational choice assumptions are, you know, the main approach is to construct relatively simple models, you know, based on a small number of assumptions and deductive reasoning. You know, so at least at the start, these things aren't highly inductive things. They're games in using deductive reasoning and experiments and such like. The assumption is of methodological individualism. So people exist primarily as individuals, and our unit of analysis is the individual rather than the social. People are instrumentally rational, so they're driven to use reason to fulfill their preferences. And some of the models that are often sort of described as unrealistic, you would often describe them as axiomatic or optimizing or maximizing. And if like me, you did an undergrad degree in economics, you were just used to this way of thinking about models. And it was, you know, you have rational individuals trying to optimize their outcomes or something like that, and then we're adding up the outcomes or based on a huge amount of individual behavior. And some of those models simply assumed that everyone had access to all of the information. They had a perfect ability to process all of that information, and they had the ability to rank their preferences consistently. So essentially, if you think back to when we talk about bounded rationality a lot, that's quite similar, except in the past with this, the idea was that you constructed models based on those kind of assumptions. Whereas when we talked about bounded rationality normally, you're talking about what happens when these conditions are not met. You imagine there are two different aims. One is bounded rationality, what happens when they're not met? Okay, well, people use cognitive shortcuts and they have to ignore most information, and then, you know, that explains agenda setting. Whereas with a lot of rational choice models, you maintain those assumptions and then ask yourself, what happens if people do have these abilities? Okay, so if you did economics, it'd be like, this is the olden days, but the first economics I did, it was about Tom Thumb maximizing his utility by buying pies, you know, and he just had full information according to what the effect of eating a pie on his utility and he knew when to stop. It was a whole, I mean, it was a great story back then, you know, but it was just to go into the assumptions or the choices people make when they have all this information. So, a lot of this is exploring these things through game theory, which really is you're identifying the choices that individuals make when you situate them within a strategic decision-making environment that provides them with incentives and disincentives. That gives them a set of payoffs, and they're also trying to anticipate the choices of other actors. And you're just trying to model or produce scenarios and what would happen to lots of people interacting within that context. Okay, so if you imagine the idea or the aim from all of those studies back in the olden days was to establish how many outcomes or what proportion of political outcomes you could explain with reference to the things I've just talked about, the choices of rational individuals under particular conditions. So there was a lot of it about, I guess this would be from the 1980s to the 2000s, something like that. When I was an undergraduate student or a postgraduate student, it was one of these, it was just like a kind of dominant, it was all we talked about was rational choice and networks and nothing else. Okay, so some of these, I think some of these examples you would probably just pick up. So I think that probably the most memorable, apart from the ones we talked about already, would be the paradox of non-voting. I don't know if you would come across that. I know everyone's being quiet because I'm recording it, right? So everyone was saying yes, they're punching the air and saying, oh, paradox of non-voting. I remember that one. But it was essentially, the question was, you know, what if everyone asks themselves, why would I bother voting when my contribution to the final outcome is minimal? You know, if I'm just looking out for some kind of return, I won't vote. And then if everyone acts like that, no one votes. And then suddenly you're thinking, well, I just need to be the only person voting. Then I'll win the election. But then if everyone thinks that, everyone votes. You know, there's a kind of cyclical logic. And then there's a kind of literature going into trying to explain why people would vote if they get such a little return from it. And to do with, you know, some of it's to do with, you know, their values and civic duty. And some of it's to do with, you know, people seeing the benefit of cooperating to defeat, you know, someone else. You know, usually if it's Scotland, you know, you vote, you know, to keep out the Tories or something like that. You know, okay, so, you know, so you imagine what that means. It's one part value driven and it's one part cooperation. And the point is, you start with the paradox as a puzzle to solve, and then you try and come up with explanations. Okay, rather than just saying, okay, none of this seems particularly realistic. And then, as I sort of suggested, you get lots of studies of bureaucracy and government, minimum winning coalitions and rent seeking and congressional committees and economic cycles that I explained in much more depth in the first edition, just because it seemed like you were kind of missing something without knowing a lot about those things. And to be honest, now 6 years later, I'm not so sure that you will lose out too much if you don't get into the depth of all these studies of all these things. Okay. But you just have to know that it's there. And I think the thing to remember would be there was a lot of methodological debate about how you should do research in politics and if it mattered that these assumptions we made are realistic or not. And I think my impression now, and it's not 2018, it's 2019, is that that kind of argument has been won by, you know, people relying on more realistic, psychologically driven explanations of human behavior, and people who model you know, unrealistic behavior tend, you know, kind of, they're not as dominant anymore. But at the time, there was this kind of bizarre discussion you could have about how you could describe the assumptions you made. And so Milton Friedman, I don't know, he was the big star in my day. Milton Friedman, they named half of our town after him and Keynes. Do you know the town? Yeah, can I give that away, right? But he came up, he had this argument, which was essentially, let's assume that people are acting as if they have a particular motivation. And one of the examples he gave that I still remember was, just assume that leaves move around a tree as if they're trying to maximize their sunlight or something like that. You know, don't worry too much if it's realistic. If it explains what happens with the tree, that's the main thing. Okay, so it was a whole. I don't feel like you're going to miss out too much if you don't get into that. Okay, but some of these matters, debates still matter now because there's still this trade-off we face between the rational choice approach, which is simple models and deduction. Okay, our discussion before, notwithstanding, about how complicated it became, you can explain prisoner's dilemmas and tragedy of the commons quite simply and use it to identify puzzles to solve. I think your competing choice we'll get into is the institutional analysis development, which is you're trying to produce a language to capture complexity based on as many in-depth studies as possible and producing a lot of uncertainty about how comparable they are with each other and a tendency to emphasize the importance of context. If you imagine you compare those, one of them is worryingly unrealistic, but really simple and easy to pick up and use. The other one is far more realistic, but incredibly complicated and very difficult to use. You know, so we don't solve anything simply by saying the world is complex, because we have to work out, you know, simple enough ways to analyze it. Okay. So that is the background, I think, for discussions of collective action. Because I think the upshot to all these discussions of rational choice is that they identify this basic problem of collective action, which is that everyone might understand a common collective outcome or the benefit of that outcome, but if they act individually, they undermine that outcome or something like that. And that's something that's worth talking about and trying to work out how we can do something about it. Okay, so we talked briefly about, you know, the logic of each of these games. You know, the prisoner's dilemma. The people involved will defect each time when they should cooperate. The collective benefit is that they should cooperate, but they tend to defect. The logic of collective action is that if an interest group is large enough, people will free ride because they can take the benefits without making any kind of contribution, because no one is really paying attention to their contribution. And the tragedy of the commons is everyone recognizes the need to maintain a common pool resource, but they value the short-term benefit of extra use to themselves more than they value the long-term benefit to the group. And they will then, if they all act on that basis, they will ruin the common resource. Okay, now these scenarios suggest that individuals have weak incentives to cooperate, and I think these two things are important. Even if it's in their interest to cooperate, and even if they agree to cooperate, you know, even under those conditions, these scenarios suggest that they will not cooperate with each other. They will satisfy their own interests, and therefore the world will go to ruin. Okay, so that prompted the person who was associated with the tragedy of the commons. So his second name is Hardin. He used this phrase, mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon, okay, which I think most people took to mean a kind of Leviathan type scenario in which we have a major state solution. Okay. Now what we can say with more certainty is that we need some kind of institutional arrangement to provide the incentives for many people to cooperate with each other. And then we can ask ourselves what these institutions should be. So maybe it should be state intervention, but we would maybe pause to ask ourselves about that, because if you accept, you know, the whole basis of this problem is that individuals act according to their own preferences at the expense of the collective good, then many state institutions will suffer the same problem. Okay, you know, civil servants will produce huge bureaucracies. Elected policymakers will extract rent from interest groups. And there are many other examples in which, you know, a state solution doesn't seem particularly effective if the problem is that people simply act according to their own, self-interest or preferences. And the second reason why we wouldn't expect a straightforward single central state controlling everything, it's based on pretty much every concept we've described before, which suggests that policymaking is necessarily multi-centric. Okay, I think the biggest reason against trying to rely on some kind of Leviathan solution is that almost every concept we've used in the course suggests that that won't happen. Okay, so that context suggests we need to find other ways to cooperate and to encourage cooperation. And that cooperation should be among individuals, and it should also be among governments. You know, if you accept that policymaking is multi-centric or polycentric, we have to find ways for people to cooperate with each other as individuals, but also to find ways for lots of different sort of autonomous governments to cooperate with each other when they don't necessarily have to do so. Okay. Now, some of this kind of literature gets into the idea that there are no simple one-off games like Prisoner's Dilemmas. All these games are repeated and are connected. And so there's this literature on evolutionary behavior that results from many repeated games. So the kind of classic one is tit for tat. I don't know if you would be familiar with this. It's a good strategy as a child. I don't know, maybe you've just forgotten it, but it would come back to you. In that, the tit for tat strategy is you first signal to someone else that you will cooperate with them. And then if they cooperate back, you continue to cooperate. You both signal to each other that you'll do so and everything works out fine. If they don't cooperate, then your response is to not cooperate, and you signal to them that you're punishing them for their non-cooperation. And then they know over the long term that it's in their interest to cooperate with you. So the idea is that tit for tat over time produces this change in behavior of people involved, because people see the incentives to cooperate under those conditions. I mean, it takes a lot of games for that to happen, but I think, you know, people like Axelrod, they would model or produce some of these kind of scenarios, and over time they tended to find that tit for tat was the strategy that won out most. Okay, so that is the context, I think, for Eleanor Ostrom's work, and I think still her most famous work is Governing the Commons. Okay, and I think, now, I could be wrong, you could try it a different way, but I think the best way to understand the institutional analysis and development framework is through the lens of Governing the Commons, because I think almost all of the concepts that we'll pick up and use are discussed in some way in that book. Okay, so it's worth reading. I think I put it on the list. It took me a while. You know, it's one of those things, I don't know how long you think it'll take you to read a book when you start it. But yeah, I look at a book and I think, okay, that'll take me a few hours. And it doesn't take you a few hours. I'll be honest, it's gonna take a hellish amount of time to kind of get into this. But I think it's worth doing. But she starts with this idea that we need to rethink the tragedy of the commons and account for the fact that these games don't explain how and why people work together. Because, you know, her starting point is, if you look at the hundreds of examples they've analysed on people trying to manage common pool resources, they found that people do cooperate. You know, they don't spoil these resources. They find ways to cooperate and extract long-term benefits from them. So I think one part is just saying, you know, that there's a too bleak view of human behaviour in the tragedy of the commons type scenario. And you can come up with a different view of human behavior, which is that people are social beings who share information, build up trust with each other, partly by becoming known as reliable and predictable. And they come together regularly to produce, monitor, and enforce rules for the group's benefit. Okay, and there's lots of evidence that people do that effectively. Okay, and that's essentially Governing the Commons is bringing together all that evidence and trying to explain it. And I think a lot of the language we would associate with it is what Ostrom has kind of applied to that kind of question to try and make sense of it. And I think one of the key things she comes up with is this idea that well-managed common pool resource projects seem to have 8 design principles. Most of the successful ones seem to have these properties. Okay, so I won't go into them too much because you can just read the list. But, you know, so the first is these resources, they have clear boundaries. So people who use them know what they are managing, and they can distinguish between people who have a legitimate role in CPR use and management and people who can be excluded. The second thing is the rules that they develop suit their local conditions, and the users of those services know what they're expected to contribute to management and what they can expect to receive from the common pool resource. So if you imagine, you know, we're talking about fishing stocks and forestry and that sort of thing. They know how many fish and how many trees they're going to get out of this thing if they cooperate with each other. The third thing is the actors affected by the rules help shape them, and it's not too costly to do so. The fourth is that the people who monitor these resources are the users themselves, or they're accountable to those users, and they monitor the conduct of users and the state of the common pool resource. And the assumption here is that the costs of doing so are low and the consequences of defection are felt very quickly. Okay, so people know that they're going to be punished quite soon. The fifth is the penalties for rule breaking have two properties. One is they're low if the choice is a one-off and it's understandable. And the rationale there is you don't punish people too heavily the first time because it will just alienate them and force them, make them not cooperate. The penalties are much higher if the choice is part of a pattern, which makes other users feel like suckers. Actually, when I've been writing this and getting feedback from the editor, he suggested I don't use the word suckers, but I think that's what's better than that. You know, you don't want to feel like a sucker following the rules when other people aren't following the rules. I don't know if you can give me another word for that, suckered into following the rules, then let me know. Okay, so the penalties are high if part of a pattern, or if the rule breaking would be catastrophic. The sixth is the conflict resolution side is frequent and quick and low cost. Otherwise, there'll be too much uncertainty about what the costs are for defection. The seventh is users have the right to self-organize without too much government interference or interference from, I think, so there's, Adela Schlager, I think, uses this phrase, I think she does, this idea of hubristic public managers who go in and tell people how to manage these resources. I think the idea here is that the emphasis is on self-management. It's minimize government interference in favor of people working together to manage these things on their own. And the eighth is that many of these projects are connected geographically and at local, regional, national scales, but in a way that doesn't undermine the individual projects. They all kind of coexist very well. Okay, so you can imagine these are the kind of principles that Ostrom took from analysing all these successful cases. And I think they outline the key requirements of good self-management, which is there's high certainty about what people get. You know, there's a clear link between the things that people contribute and the things that they get in return. There's certainty about the rewards people get from their efforts. And there are high levels of trust between people to follow the rules. Okay, and if so, then that produces a sense within individuals that they're prepared to cooperate to forgo short-term selfish reward for long-term collective reward. Okay, so, you know, the idea is instead of privatizing these things or having massive state intervention to solve these tragedies of the commons, you produce a collection of rules between autonomous people that means that they can self-manage these resources. And, you know, so imagine there's a kind of, I don't know how much we want to talk about this, but there's a kind of ideological side to this where this is trying to explain and encourage limited state intervention. You know, okay, so that these kind of ideas, I think, would be received in different places in different ways. Okay. So that's relatively straightforward, I think, when you describe it like that. Then things get complicated. So I think Ostrom presents this idea that none of these design principles give you any kind of blueprint for action. You can't simply take the eight things and design a system because you know, the whole point is that people will foster trust with each other by producing these rules together, you know, rather than have them presented to them. So So lots of things that go into that say that things are a bit more complicated. So the first is that the principles foster trust, but trust is much more about is much more than design. It's about evolution or long-term cooperation, giving people the sense of who they are and how reliable they are. The context matters in each case, and the rules are fantastically complicated. Okay, so if you get into this kind of field, I think you will find that it's incredibly detailed, and at least for the first time, incredibly difficult to pick up. Okay, now I've made the investment, so I now feel like I should say it's worth the investment, right? But okay, but it's not. There's some things like kingdom you can just pick up and use. You get the idea, the metaphor. With this, you don't just pick up and use it. There's a whole bunch of rules involved, and it's not just a collection of rules. It's a whole bunch of rules about rules, and different kinds of rules. And I'm sure there's a whole book about the rules. I don't know if I'm selling this thing, okay? But there is one book that Ostrom wrote in 2005, which kind of tries to lay out categories of rules that people follow to cooperate. Okay, and it's they include considerations like how many actors are part of an action situation, and we haven't just defined action situation yet. The role the actors play in this situation, what they must and must not do, who is eligible to participate, who can move from one role to another, who controls the membership and how they do so, how many participants are involved in a choice, what will happen if there's no agreement, how to manage and communicate information, how to produce the rewards and sanctions, and how to decide the range of acceptable actions or outcomes from action. Okay, so imagine these are the kinds of things extracted from analyses of many different cases, okay, to identify these rules. Okay, and that's the relatively straightforward part. And then there is also this analysis of the rules. I'll do this for comic effect if I get it right. The rules about the rules about the rules about the rules. Okay, so if you imagine the simplest rules are operational. It's the day-to-day rules about what the payoffs and sanctions should be for behavior. Okay, so I guess we could come to an agreement between ourselves quite easily about what are the, if we, I don't know, we manage a fishing stock, what are the punishments for people taking too much of themselves or something. That's nice and straightforward. Then if you go up a level, you have collective choice rules, which are the rules about how to make those operational rules. Now I think this is more intuitive than you might think at first. I think a lot of people go into these rules on Twitter. Part of the reason people can't agree on things is that they don't agree on the rules that they're going to use to decide who's right and the thing they're talking about. Okay, but that's rules about how to make rules. The third level is constitutional rules on who can decide how to make those rules and who can monitor and enforce them. And then there are meta-constitutional discussions about how to design those constitutions with reference to the wider political and social context. Okay, imagine this makes a bit more sense when you look at it in the source text, because they show it visually with nice circles and arrows and that sort of thing. Comforting image more than mine. I think the way I describe it, it just sounds very confusing. Okay, then if you imagine there are these other rules, and they are the kind of rules we use to set criteria to evaluate the outcomes. Because if you imagine the point of this management of institutions is to make them successful. You evaluate the outcomes of the institution, and you found it to be successful in some way and more successful than another system. But there are lots of different ways in which you could decide what makes for a successful management of a common pool resource. So one is that it's economically efficient. Another is that it's equitable. And that equity could be to do with the relationship between the contribution you make and the reward, or it could be in relation to your ability to pay to take part. The criteria could be how much of this activity is in line with the values of the people involved, about how you should reward cooperation and punish defection. And so if you want to look into that in more detail culturally, that's the bit in, okay, this never works, right? But if I record it, you can listen back and then you can check, right? This is the bit in Batman Begins when he's invited to off the guy who's stolen something from them. So he refuses. Okay, it's a great scene. I'm not selling it very well, but it's a great scene because essentially they can't agree on what the punishments, what the proportionate punishments for non-cooperation. Okay. Then other ways to evaluate outcomes are in terms of how conducive is this system to high trust, low conflict relationships? How conducive is it to effective accountability mechanisms? And how conducive is it to the sustainability of these common pool resources? Okay, so that is way into the sort of 101 concepts and definitions you get with the institutional analysis and development framework. Partly you've got so many different rules and categories and complications is they're trying to make sense of an incredibly complicated set of common pool resources and extract a kind of a set of rules from them. Okay. I'm going to pause for a second. Okay, so that's the context, I think, for more recent developments, which are slightly more complicated than the thing I described there. Okay, so the most recent development in terms of the IED is this reference to socio-ecological systems. If you imagine a kind of simple way to understand socio-ecological systems is is as a combination of two things. One is the description I just gave you there of the IED in relation to governing the commons. The other is, as at the same time as Ostrom produced that kind of work, lots of other people in the ecological sciences have produced their own approaches to complex socio-ecological systems. So essentially this is putting those two things together. It's an interdisciplinary effort in which you've got social scientists and ecological sciences trying to work out how to save the planet by theorizing it in a simple enough way. Okay, so it's worth looking at Ostrom's 2009 article that she lays this out in four pages in Science, and you see this picture, and I put that on one of the blogs as well. The picture is of these so-called first-level concepts in which they're trying to identify the key factors. Okay, and that would be the users of a system, the governance system they use to regulate their behavior, the resource system, which is something like a protected park, and the resource units, such as its trees. Okay, and if you look at that, Ostrom is asking similar questions, which are like, when will the users of a resource invest the time and energy to avert a tragedy of the commons? Okay. And it answers that question with reference to what she calls second level concepts, which are about the factors that encourage users to value the long-term sustainability of something and self-organize to secure this outcome. So I produced, the way she describes it for me is a little bit more complicated than I like. So I produced a kind of summary table of that in which some of the second level variables, you can see how they work. So for example, I won't read them all out, but you imagine one of the factors is the size of the system. And it says if it's too large, the costs of establishing boundaries are too high. If it's too small, there are insufficient benefits to collective action. So it's very much, it's like a Goldilocks type approach to the size of a system. It's the same with its productivity. If it's too abundant, if you can get too much fish from a sea or too many trees from a forest without too much effort, then the users will see little reason to worry about the resource to do anything about it. If it's too depleted, it will seem too late to manage for the long term. Okay, which is a bit like, I think we agreed earlier that, ultimately everything's too late, isn't it? We're all or just killing time till Armageddon. So there's a whole bunch of second level variables like that, in which you identify these factors, you can identify the ways in which what people might cooperate. And actually, some people, if they can invest the time to understand the framework, use it as a kind of diagnostic type approach. You know, what ecological system are we interested in, and how can we use these questions to diagnose how to make it more effective? Okay, so then we have a few. If you imagine, if you think of the idea as a tree, you have lots of different branches of different approaches that take it as an inspiration to look at other things. Now, one of those approaches is called ecology of games, which refers to a kind of much older idea that all of the games we talked about take place all at the same time, and they essentially interact with each other. So people like Mark Lebel use this idea of ecology of games. And if you imagine, you start with the stuff we've talked about with the IED, and you incorporate some of the other concepts and theories that we've talked about in the course. Okay, so they talk about complex systems. So an ecology of games suggests maybe you've got 101 different institutions dealing with the same problem at the same time. Okay, then he talks about bounded rationality and says that, you know, people follow social tribal instincts to deal with it. They form coalitions to cooperate with some people and compete with others. Okay, and he says if you put those three together, then you find at the scale of major national and global problems, there are a huge number of games taking place at the same time, a huge number of institutions to deal with them, and a huge number of actors interacting with each other, all with different beliefs. Okay. And the focus is on how you can try and reduce the cost of cooperation between all of those people, but in the context of a remarkably complex system. Okay. And then finally, we can relate this back to multi-centric policymaking that we talked about last week. Right. So imagine if you say policymaking is multi-centric, partly by design. You know, people choose to have many levels and types of government, but it's partly by necessity. Then these studies are focusing on how to make sure that these polycentric arrangements are effective, and they focus on reducing the transactions costs of cooperation between each other. Okay. So there's another literature, another branch, which is the institutional collective action framework, which goes into the factors you can produce to reduce the transactions costs of cooperating with each other. Okay. So the aim is to foster trust, maximize information sharing, and reduce the cost of enforcing contracts. So they talk about things like face-to-face meetings, shared values, transparent arrangements so you don't have to collect a lot of information, and producing quick wins between each other so that they know that there's some benefit to cooperate with each other. Okay, so let's try and tie all those things together in a conclusion. Okay, so if you return to the problem, imagine we started off with this idea with these simple games that collective action between lots of individuals seems unlikely. Catastrophes are just around the corner, associated with things like tragedies of common. Therefore, you know, some of these arguments are we need to do something drastic, like massive state intervention to deal with these tragedies. And the view of humanity there is quite bleak. Okay, you can choose to have a more hopeful view of humanity and come up with a different solution to that problem. Okay, now the hopeful thing is if you're looking for cooperative arrangements between people to solve the world's problems, we have to focus on things like how you develop trust enough for people to cooperate to avert tragedies. Okay, so that's really what we've been talking about with the institutional analysis and development. It's the identification of design principles and rules and levels of rules to produce trust and to make sure people will know what the benefits are of cooperation and so on. Okay, but the second take home, I think, is if we return to the trade-offs to academic analysis. Okay, so the first thing we started off with, and I should have stressed this more, is that part of the reason rational choice type discussions went out of fashion is because the assumptions were so unrealistic, people didn't really think they were worth dealing with. You know, you're making all these assumptions about people and producing games and producing simple models. Why would you bother? Okay. Now, I think one of the reasons to bother comes from the discussion I laid out over the last 40 minutes, which is if you try and replace simple models with a kind of clear moral with something more realistic and complicated, you end up with the sort of things I talked about. If you go with the idea that the world is complicated and people are following all sorts of different rules at different levels, then to replace rational choice simplicity with something more complex requires you to invest all that time in understanding all those concepts. So I would say one of the answers to that question, why would you maintain these simple models, is simply because if you don't, that you may describe a world in such a complicated way that you don't remember any of it when you're finished. Okay, so I think you would probably remember the moral of the prisoner's dilemma, okay, or the moral of the tragedy of the commons. But it's much more difficult, I think, to remember the moral of the institutional analysis and development framework or connect it to all those other theories we talked about. So that essentially is the rub that we have with all this kind of methodological discussion. We're trading off simplicity and complexity. It's too easy to just say that the world is complex and we have to analyze it that way, because if we take that choice, then we produce this kind of discussion, which is, I think, I was keeping an eye on the kind of the body language, and I would say it's very much, there's no way, okay, I would say it starts off with, I'm really going to try and pay attention to this. Then it's, I'm struggling to pay attention to this. And then by the end of it is, I really resent you asking me to pay attention to this. And then the final stage, I refuse to remember any of this stuff. And I think that's a reasonable conclusion you would come to, you know, because you're having to invest your time in particular theories and you have to trade off simplicity for complexity. Okay. Okay, if I do that again, I'll try and come up with something more positive at the end. Okay, I suppose the more positive thing is if you do invest that time, you clearly understand a kind of complex part of the literature and you can use it. Okay, but I think if you meet any people who do this kind of work and you ask them any kind of question, they always say, well, hang on, that's not a simple question to answer. You know, give me 10 minutes and they look so pained, you know, so I would, yeah. Think twice about investing the time.